From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The holiday shopping season is here. 92 million shoppers went to the stores on Black Friday, another 45 million on Thanksgiving Day, all rushing to get the best deals on holiday gifts and make their dollars stretch. But what about the person behind the counter? At the register, stocking the shelves, working in the food court, trying to get by on minimum wage or a little bit more. Millions of Americans are working full-time for more or less poverty pay. So what to do about it? This hour On Point, solving America's low-wage conundrum. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Is it time to crank up the minimum wage? Will that do it? Punching in at $7.25 an hour yourself? Was that you picketing Walmart last week? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later in this hour, we will look at Pope Francis' tough new critique of capitalism as practiced these days, his critique of an economy he wrote recently of exclusion and inequality. But first, from Washington, Reed Wilson joins us, reporter for The Washington Post, senior political policy blogger for the Post's GovBeat blog. Reed Wilson, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You are tracking what's going on with minimum wage initiatives around the country. What's it look like, Reed?
Well, here in Washington, D.C., President Obama and congressional Democrats say that they want to increase the $7.25 federal minimum wage. That's not going to happen with a Republican House of Representatives and with only 55 Democrats in the U.S. Senate. So around the country, we're seeing labor activists and Democratic sort of strategists pushing these minimum wage hikes. And in a lot of places, they've been very successful. California just passed a minimum wage hike that will increase the state's wage to $10 an hour. That'll be the highest statewide minimum wage.
$10 in 2015, is it, Reed?
That's right. It goes up gradually over a couple of years. That'll be the highest minimum wage for now. Other states like Massachusetts and Washington State and South Dakota, even in Arkansas, are considering minimum wage hikes. Even in cities, we're seeing higher wages. The city of SeaTac, Washington, where the SeaTac International Airport is Seattle's main airport, just passed a bill that would increase the minimum wage for airport workers to $15 an hour. That's significantly higher than the $9.19 that Washington State pays on an hourly basis for the minimum wage.
So $15 an hour, that was a bill or a popular vote there, a referendum?
That was an initiative that went to the people of SeaTac, all 12,000 registered voters of them. About 6,100 people ended up voting. The minimum wage hike passed by 77 votes.
Wow.
The two sides spent so much money. They spent about $327 per vote in SeaTac fighting over that minimum wage hike.
And it only passed by 77 votes, but pass it did. This is a municipality of 27,000 residents just around the airport there, I guess. A lot of immigrant residents working at what they have, I guess, felt have been too low wages at the airport. We'll see how that works out over time. When higher minimum wage gets raised in a city or in a state, what are the forces that come out for and against it? What's it look like?
Well, on one side, you've got the labor unions pushing for wage hikes. We saw the Service Employees International Union pushing very hard for the wage hike in SeaTac. On the other side, you've got the business interests who are going to have to pay those bills. Alaska Airlines, which has a hub at SeaTac, fought hard against the measure. So did the local restaurant association and the Chamber of Commerce spent a bunch of money there trying to argue against it. But so these are sort of the coalitions that form across the country. It is labor unions that say that a higher minimum wage leads to sort of a rising tide that lifts all boats, and business interests that say a higher minimum wage is going to put a burden on their bottom line and maybe even force them to let some folks go.
New Jersey voted for a higher minimum wage, I think $8.25, but Governor Chris Christie's against it. Where's that likely to go?
This is really interesting. Chris Christie won by a huge margin back in November, and yet at the same time, voters passed this minimum wage hike by an equally large margin. So voters were really voting for the person, I think, in that particular election, and not, in fact, for the on that particular minimum wage issue. They liked the issue. They didn't so much mind that Chris Christie opposed it. But the wage hike is now law in New Jersey. It's going to be the minimum wage once again will rise. This this is one way that Democrats are able to pass minimum wage legislation even without control of state legislative chambers or the governor's mansion or sort of any of the mechanisms of government. I mentioned South Dakota and Arkansas as two places where we might see minimum wage ballot initiatives hit the ballot this coming November, in November 2014, that is through the popular vote. Democrats and labor unions go out and collect as many signatures as they can to get these measures on the ballot. And once they are, Democrats think that they can use that as a way to sort of portray themselves as the party of the working person and the Republicans as the party of big business. That proved an effective tool back in 2012 when President Obama beat Mitt Romney. Now Democrats are trying to duplicate that in a lot of red states.
Republicans tending to oppose, and yet I'm looking at poll numbers here that show that a lot of Republican citizens actually favor higher minimum wage.
Yeah, polls show that, broadly speaking, Americans favor a higher minimum wage. The margin is pretty significant among Democratic voters. It's relatively large among independent voters. And it's, as you say, most Republican voters, or many Republican voters, I should say, back hiking the minimum wage. So once you get into elective office, though, you've got sort of you get a different tug and pull. It's not just your constituents that you're talking to. It's also the business interests that play a big role in a lot of state capitals and the labor unions that advocate on the other side that play an equally large role in many capitals. Despite what voters say, you know, even an 80% issue, like, for example, earlier this year, the measure to expand universal background checks on guns, even though an overwhelming number of Americans supported that bill, that doesn't always translate into legislative action or legislative votes.
Now, some conservatives, though, have pushed for it. California has had this push to raise the minimum wage, and a big conservative at the heart of it, Ron Unz, Silicon Valley millionaire, zillionaire, I don't know, saying, making the case that a higher minimum wage would mean less spending on social welfare programs.
And that's a good argument that a lot of minimum wage backers, or rather those who favor raising the minimum wage, will make, is that the higher the wage, the more likely somebody is to rise out of poverty and not be dependent on that job at McDonald's or Walmart for the rest of their lives. And the higher wage you get, it sort of translates into being able to save some money, which then allows you to send your kid to college or go to a community college yourself. And eventually get a higher paying job. So we're seeing that argument a lot in some states. A state like Nevada, they're even instituting things like college savings plans, the 529 plans, where mm-hmm. you can save tax-free for your kids, and seeding that money in a lot of rural counties with $50, simply because the state has seen some studies that suggest that having the basis for savings makes somebody multiples more likely to work their way out of poverty.
Hard to have savings on $7.25 an hour. How does that current federal minimum wage compare to what it's been historically, adjusted for inflation? Is it about where it's been, higher, lower?
Well, it's lower than it was back in the 60s and 70s, even though in the 60s and 70s it was, a buck and a half, $2 an hour. But of course, inflation means that the $2 then was worth more than the $7.25 now. And in a lot of states, the state minimum wage has lagged far behind, and it affects different industries differently. There are a couple of states. I'm sitting right across the Potomac River from Virginia. Virginia is one of them. That actually pay a much lower minimum wage than the federal level for certain industries. And those industries are restaurants, bars, places where people can get tips. A server can make, say, $3.25 an hour under the assumption that they're going to be tipped at a rate that would eventually get them up to the federal minimum wage. So that's another way that some of these businesses can get around paying the $7.25 federal wage.
And, of course, you've got other cities who are carving out their own wage. San Francisco, I think, even Washington, D.C., looking to do something of its own.
What's happening in Washington is really fascinating. There are a couple of regional governments here that all control the minimum wage that are banding together to raise that minimum wage so that they are not losing businesses to the other side of the Potomac River. The three jurisdictions that have done that are, or that are planning to do it, Montgomery County, Maryland, which is just to the northwest of Washington, Prince George's County, Maryland, which is to the northeast, and Washington, D.C. itself. Later this week, the city council is going to vote on a measure to raise the minimum wage to $11.50 an hour. That would match the other two jurisdictions. That means that a business that's located three blocks inside Montgomery County won't have an incentive to move to Washington because Montgomery County's minimum wage is higher. They'll be able to stay there, and they believe that that sort of raising the minimum wage altogether is going to help them keep those businesses and still help their local employees. On the other side of the river in Virginia, the localities don't control the minimum wage. That's something that the state controls. So they can't quite make that complete regional coalition there, but they're trying.
Reed, I've just got you for half a minute here, but I wonder about the implications of this checkerboard of different minimum wages all over the country, even within a given state.
Well, for most businesses, it's not going to matter. If you are a deli owner or a McDonald's franchisee or something, you're not going to move your business from one state or the other simply because of a minimum wage hike. But for major business, for big business, it could make a big difference. If you're a Walmart or something, opening a new store in Alexandria, Virginia versus Washington, D.C., is going to have a big impact. So we might see this sort of patchwork causing people to make business decisions, but I think really only on the larger business scale.
Reed Wilson with us, their senior political policy blogger for the Washington Post GovBeat blog. Reed, thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's low wage crisis, looking for a way up and out of the poverty wage trap where millions of Americans seem to find themselves these days. Big push on just in the last week. Picketers outside Walmart around the country this week call for strikes at fast food outlets across the country. Here's Nancy Salgado, 27-year-old, single mother of two, one of the leaders of the group Fight for 15. She's been working for $8.25 an hour at McDonald's for years, talking about getting to $15 an hour, what that would mean for her family and her. Here she's talking with CBS.
We'll be able to spend a little bit more. We'll be able to shop a little bit more. I'm not looking for a rich life, you know?
Well, but you're not going to be rich even on $15
an hour. Exactly. But what I'm looking for is to be able to be safe and living well.
Safe and living well. $15 an hour, Aaron Moriarty says, not that high. Stephen Colbert having fun with all this, even back in July, poking fun at protesters around the country, but in a sympathetic way, asking food giants like McDonald's to raise their wages to that $15 mark.
$15 an hour? What do they think? Those arches are made of gold? I mean, the consequences, folks, the consequences of a wage increase are horrifying to contemplate. At last count, there are 3.6 million frontline cashiers, cooks, and crew in America's fast food industry. A living wage would eliminate 3.6 million poor people. That's the kind of thing Hitler used to talk about.
I don't know what he means it's talking about exactly, but it's Stephen Colbert. Last night, The Daily Show host Jon Stewart took aim at Walmart after arrests were made at a protest for fair labor conditions in Ontario, California on Black Friday.
Outside an Ontario, California Walmart, a man dressed as Santa Claus was arrested as part of the protest.
Oh, my God. How bad does your organization have to be for Santa to be protesting your labor conditions? The man runs an elf sweatshop.
Okay, it's funny and it's not. We're talking about low wages in this country, lots of people on them, and looking at what they ought to be, how to raise them one way or another. Joining us now from Washington is David Cooper, analyst at the Economic Policy Institute, founded by economists like Robert Reich, Robert Kuttner, gets part of its funding from labor unions, including United Auto Workers, United Food and Commercial Workers Union. David Cooper, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also with us from Washington is Jason Fichtner, Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, center founded by Richard Fink, Executive VP at Koch Industries, as in Koch Brothers, funded through donations from companies like ExxonMobil and Koch Industries. Jason Fichtner, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be here again.
All right. Here we are. David, first to you. Do we have a low-wage crisis in this country, or just such a huge number of people working for $7.25 an hour or near that you can feel guilty going out to shop sometimes?
Tom, I think it is a crisis. I mean, arguably, when you have someone who's earning so little that they can barely afford their own to make ends meet, to afford their basic living expenses, then that is a crisis, particularly for that person. But I think it's also a larger crisis for the country, because when you have so many workers that are earning so little and they can't go out and buy the things that they need to buy, that's a problem for the larger country, for the larger economy, because that has a cooling effect on demand in the country. If you look at the problem that's facing our economy right now, it's that there just isn't enough demand. There isn't enough customers for businesses. And if people aren't receiving enough income to go out and buy the things they need, then that's just going to slow down demand even more. You know, 70% of U.S. GDP is consumer spending. If people can't go out and buy, if businesses don't have customers, then that whole system is going to start to break down. We're going to get slow growth, and we get caught in this trap of low wages, low demand, and slow job growth. And that's what the country is facing right now.
It can feel like a trap lately. Jason Fichtner, let me get your opening read on this. All these people on very low wages, is this a problem? Is it a crisis?
Well, I think there's a bigger picture here, Tom, that we're not discussing, and we're using the minimum wage as sort of a red herring. And the biggest problem we have
you
right
raised
now
it, not me. I've got a lot of things on my mind, but where are you going?
What I'm raising is we're not doing a good enough job educating our workforce so that there's a demand for higher wage labor. And right now what we have, unfortunately, is an education system. If you look at those who are on the minimum wage, they tend to be young, single, female, and without a high school education. And they're having a hard time making ends meet a minimum wage. But the idea is a minimum wage is not supposed to be a lifelong career. It's supposed to be a gateway to a better job when you get a better education. How do we do things to support those people so they can get a better education, get more skilled, and then get higher paid jobs so that the employer sees value in paying them more for a higher skilled
work? But what if we
work?
Don't do those things? We've talked for a long time about better education, and we don't seem to be delivering it. New numbers just out today showing, you know, U.S. students way at the back of the pack in terms of global competition. What if we don't do it?
You know, my fear is if we just resort to raising the minimum wage, what we end up doing is actually hurting some people more than we help some people. There's no doubt that raising the minimum wage for those who would keep their job would see benefits. But the research does show that for some people, they'd lose their jobs. For some, there wouldn't be a new job available. And for those, we're doing more harm than good.
But what's your suggestion then? I mean, how can we just go along with all these millions of people just barely getting by or not really getting by, you know, working at Walmart but on food stamps? That doesn't seem like a great formula either.
Well, so here's how, because people want to do short-term solutions. They're always looking for how do we do this today and not looking for something long-term. I think we can better target our dollars instead of minimum wage to more government programs that really are forceful with child tax credits, EITC expansion. And we should look at those with food stamps, because what you don't want to do, Tom, is raise the minimum wage for people who are teenagers or really are using the minimum wage as a transition to a bigger job.
But that's only 24% of the people who make minimum wage.
Well, then for
that's 24%. You know, 38% are up to 29 years old, 14 up to 39, 11 up to 49. You've got, 12%, 50 plus.
So let's target them to the tax code to give them more tax incentives, a higher earned income tax credit, because we can target those folks who need it, not those who don't. A minimum wage expansion overall gets everybody, and one size fits all does not work in this country.
David Cooper, so Jason's got minimum wage on the table. What do you think about it? Is that a good idea? You've got states and localities saying $7.25 is just too low. We're going to push it up. Is that a good idea for localities, for states? What about for the country, David?
I think it absolutely is the right idea for the country. And the only reason you're seeing it so much at the state and locality level right now is because states and localities have recognized that $7.25 is far too low, and they're not willing to wait for Congress to raise the federal minimum wage. We know that Congress isn't really able to get a whole lot done these days. And I want to respond to a couple of things that Jason has said. You know, he started saying that we need to raise education, and I absolutely agree that we need to be doing everything we can to give people access to education. But when you look at what's happened in wages at basically every education level over the last few years, you know, there hasn't been this huge growth in wages for highly educated people. Wages for those people have been just as flat as it's been for low-wage workers, or excuse me, for low-educated folks. So just more education is not the sole solution to this problem. The other thing he said was, you know, he mentioned that the minimum wage workers are mostly young, single, female, and low education. And that really isn't true. You know, if you look at just the people who are making explicitly the federal minimum wage of $7.25, that may be a substantial portion of them. But you also have to remember that there's a lot of people who are making just above that amount. There's people making $7.30, $7.40. Maybe they're making a state minimum wage of $8.25. That's not really that much more money in terms of income. And when you look at that broader group of people earning between $7.25 and, say, $10 an hour, which is what some members of Congress have proposed raising the federal minimum wage to, the picture of those workers is very different. The average age of the workers in that range is 35 years old.
What about the argument that if you raise the minimum wage, you get a pop right away for people, mm-hmm. but that you get bad follow-on effects? I mean, my dad, he's kind of a conservative, curmudgeon, good heart, but he was in town over Thanksgiving and said, you raise that minimum wage, you know, and you're going to have fewer jobs out there. You know, the dollar menu is going to go away at McDonald's. Prices are going to go up. You're going to have all kinds of knock-on effects that you don't want.
Right. So this is actually probably one of, if not the most heavily researched topics in labor economics, at least over the last few years. And there is, you know, this very intuitive thought that, well, if you raise the cost of labor, then necessarily you're going to have job losses. And the reason for this is early research tended to kind of to show results that would reinforce this textbook notion. But starting in the early 1990s, we started to look at these effects a little more closely. There was a landmark study by David Card and Alan Krueger. And Alan Krueger, you may remember, was President Obama's former chair of the Council of Economic Advisors. Yep. And they looked at what happened in fast food restaurants along the border between New Jersey and Pennsylvania when New Jersey raised its minimum wage and Pennsylvania didn't. And what they saw was that in New Jersey, where the minimum wage went up, you actually saw employment go up slightly in those fast food restaurants, which really sort of was a sea change moment for the minimum wage literature. And since then, a lot of other research have replicated the Card and Krueger method, extending it to places all throughout the country. There was a paper just a few years ago that looked at every single instance where you had these border counties where one state raised its minimum wage and the other one didn't for the last 20 years. And they concluded that raising the minimum wage had no measurable effect
on employment. Let's get a reality check here right from what you might call the front lines. Tiffany Berard joins us right now. David Cooper, Jason Fichtner, please stand by. Tiffany is 29 years old, a married mother of two, works at Walmart in Laurel, Maryland. She's been with the company for a couple of years now, making about $12,000 a year, working pretty much full-time. She was among those, I think, who was making some noise last week, unhappy about those wages. Tiffany Berard in Maryland, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
What's it like getting what's your hourly wage, Tiffany?
My hourly wage is $10.70 an hour.
So you're way above the minimum wage, and I hear your kids right there. How is it living on $10.75?
It's a struggle living off of $10.70 an hour because my hours is inconsistent at Walmart because I don't make a full 40 hours. I made $12,000 last year, so you can imagine what that looked like when you have to pay rent and utility bills.
How many hours do you average a week, or what's the range from what to what in terms of hours per week?
1 week I may earn anywhere from 19 to 25 hours, and then the next week the same thing, 19 to 25 hours. I average a 40-hour week 40 hours over 2 weeks period of time.
Okay. Can you work more if you ask for it? Could you get more hours and pump your income up?
Right now, they don't let us ask for more hours. They even cut our overtime. Walmart doesn't want to give us no more than what we're scheduled.
So what are you asking for?
Basically, I'm asking for a living wage, which is $25,000 a year, with consistency in scheduling. Because if we made $25,000 a year, or if it averaged out to a little bit over $13 an hour with a full 40-hour work week, it would equal up to $25,000 a year, which would be more than enough to get by.
What do you say, Tiffany, to my guest Jason, who says, look, I mean, his advice is you should have got more education, Tiffany. You'd be in a better position to make a better living now.
Correct. I think right now choosing a better education will force to go into the trade field. Right now, because I'm married, my husband and I are taking turns entering the trade field. He just finished the electrician program, and it's my turn coming up this year to enter the trade field. But we still have to work because our bills won't go away. We do have two kids, and the expenses with them will never go away.
So maybe you should wait until you get more education to expect a higher wage. Does that sound reasonable or cruel?
I really think it sounds cruel, not reasonable, because it's not only me. It's a lot of other people out here across the U.S. that's going through the same thing. I'm a little more fortunate because I do have a husband, but we have to think about the elderly and the widowed people and the single people that do have children that can't afford to go back to college right now because they do have bills in the way.
Do you see them working at Walmart too, Tiffany?
Yes, we have numerous of them that work across the country at Walmart. That's one of the reasons why I went on strike last Tuesday, and I went on protest last Friday, and I'm going to continue to fight for me, myself, and the others that are employed by Walmart for Walmart to pay us $25,000 a year because that will get us to where we need to be.
Tiffany Berard in Laurel, Maryland, good luck to you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Got a lot of callers lined up here. John in Boston, you're on the air, John. What do you think?
I think that they should definitely raise the minimum wage up to a cost that is the amount that it takes to live and the minimum place that it takes to live. And I don't see no reason why any companies, these big companies, are getting richer and richer and richer while the poor are getting poorer and poorer and poorer. They're not going to be able to take the money with them when they die one day. They got more money than they swim in, and they want to cry about someone making much money just to make a living. I don't really have no sympathy for them on that account.
John, I appreciate your call. You're breaking up a little bit right there, but I think we've got the gist of it. Jason, there's John who says, you know, look, American companies appear to be doing pretty well. Everybody knows there's a lot of cash stacked up there. We've got very high executive salaries that have grown much higher as a multiple of ordinary workers. Does that suggest that there's more to go around? Would it necessarily hurt those companies? David Cooper says it might help them because you would pump up demand with better wages at the bottom.
Well, I you know, this is in a hard position to be in this studio because it sounds like I'm the cold-hearted conservative who says people deserve what they get. They should get more education and be happy with what they got. And that's not the message I'm trying to put forward. What I'm saying is that there are tough times out there. And people like Tiffany, you know, my heart goes out to her. I'm sitting here listening to her. And the American dream is you come to this country, you're born in this country, and if you work hard, play by the rules, you can succeed. And people no longer feel that's the case. They feel that they're getting gypped. And I think they're using the minimum wage, again, as a red herring to move this forward. What I'd like to see with someone like Tiffany is I want to help her. How can we help target people like her through the tax code, through the social welfare system, to give her a leg up so that she can have the time and opportunity to go back and get more education, to get a higher paying job?
But my question stands right there in front of you, Jason, still. Why not? If we've got, you know, we've got enormous cash reserves, we've got very high salaries in a lot of these companies, is it really the case that there's not more in the American economy as it stands right now to share? And if we shared, David says the economy would be better off, including the companies. What do you say?
Well, so I don't think that's true. And here's a thought exercise. So okay, People are arguing for raising the minimum wage to $10, $10.50, or in Seattle, Tacoma, $15. If a little bit is good, let's just go bold. Let's make minimum wage $100 an hour.
Let's
just do it. Well, okay. Now, so you just realized the point right there. When you start raising the cost of something, you get less. So my cousin, you mentioned your father. My cousin just had his hours reduced. He's at a near minimum wage job because the Affordable Care Act is raising the cost of labor. So he's now going from a full-time job to a part-time
job.
But
profits are high. Cash reserves are enormous. Doesn't that factor in salaries at the high end are high? Doesn't that factor in here somewhere?
But you're not using a normative justification for we should force people to pay a wage when what really happens is the economy drives by the profit incentive. And if that profit incentive isn't there, it's not going to happen and we can't force it. If we raise minimum wage, so at the beginning of the show, Reed Wilson talked about Maryland and D.C. trying to raise their wage. And McDonald's might not move, but a Walmart surely is going to move across the street to Virginia. And other businesses might as well. When you raise the cost of labor, you get less of it. And the question is, that's why I use that thought experiment of $100 an hour. It's going to make a difference. The question is, how do we not use that to help people? How do we use other systems, the tax code and our social welfare system, to help them out, which we can do today as well?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's low-wage crisis, conundrum, what do you call it? We're looking for a way up and out of the poverty wage trap. Look around and you can see that. With David Cooper of the Economic Policy Institute, Jason Fichtner at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. A little later in this segment, we will go to Rome, hear about the Pope, Pope Francis, who has come out with a very tough statement on the, some of the failings as the new Pope sees them of contemporary capitalism and inequality. Tough statement out of him. We'll hear about it. David Cooper, I want to give you an at-bat here. A couple of calls first, and we'll come right to you. Billy in Clarksville, Tennessee. Billy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I was just, you know, I think back of my parents and when I was a child. I'm 32 years old now, and they didn't make a lot. You know, they made $7 an hour back in the 80s, $7.50. But, you know, in today's terms, if you made $7.50 an hour, back in 1986, that would be about like making $22 to $23 an hour almost now in inflation, you know. And now I make almost that and I'm struggling. And it's, you know, I really just don't feel that we've kept up with inflation at all. It's a person needs to make a whole lot more today to live like you could making a lot less back then.
Hey, Billy, are you saying you're making $22 an hour and struggling or seven plus?
I make close to 22 now, so little over that. Actually.
So you're almost three times the minimum wage, and you think you're struggling.
Yeah,
yikes.
Well, with student loans and getting out of college, you know, it gets a little rough, you know, and still there's people that make a lot less than me and struggle a lot less, and I think it's horrible that corporations, when someone's making, you know, several million dollars a year, but yet they have people on food stamps working for them, barely living, and their kids are starving.
Walmart, McDonald's get criticized there as sort of leaning on welfare themselves. Billy, I appreciate your call. David Cooper, you hear Jason Fichtner's retort here. He says, be careful, you know, you'll kill the goose here as you try and raise the bottom.
Yeah, I think that that's largely overblown. You know, the thought experiment that Jason was suggesting of raising the minimum wage to $100, no one's talking about that. We're talking about modest increases in the minimum wage along the same lines as what we've done in the past. And again, all the research has shown that increases of that size really have no negative effect on employment, but they do measurably raise people's incomes. And that's really critical right now. We need to get more money in the hands of people that are going to spend it right away to try and jumpstart this economy a little bit and help out these people like your callers that are really struggling to make ends meet on a daily basis.
I mean, people want to do it in a sustainable way, but, you know, maybe raising the bottom a little bit would help. Tom in Davenport, Iowa. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
As an MBA student, I'm an MBA student. I'm also I work for corporate America, but I'm not working for a company where we have millionaires sitting on our staff, and my in-laws also own a small family business.
Okay.
So I see kind of two ends of the coin. I definitely can see the need where people feel that raising the income would definitely help them. However, I feel that to raise everything, you would definitely find that, you know, once you raise the cost of labor, you're going to have to raise the prices of everything through production, and eventually you're going to end up right back where you started, just at a higher dollar value of what that is.
But look around, Tom. What's your solution then? You're an MBA candidate. Look around. You see what's happened to the middle class, how low this minimum wage is now, and there are too many people working on it.
Absolutely.
How do we fix this?
Absolutely. I think that going to your guest point about looking at different ways with taxes, I think that is a key area. But I also think that there could be a value even if you you're working somewhere for a while, your income does increase. So you do go above the minimum wage if you work somewhere for more than, you know, a few years, rather than just kind of jumping from job to job to job as a college student. You know, when I was a college student, I wouldn't have expected to make as much as somebody who had a family. I was a shoe salesman, and I didn't see it as anything more than the minimum wage. That was what I expected to make at that job. However, I think that when people have a family and people who have worked at a place a lot longer than just a few months, you know, there should be some value to that as well.
Well, there should be. Here we've got Jess writing to us on Twitter as we speak, Tom, says, I have a BA, working on a master's, working in fast food, hundreds of resumes sent out, no calls, there are no other jobs. Another tweet from Jess says, retail is not a stepping stone if there's nowhere to step to. I appreciate your call, Tom. Good luck there. Jerry in Oklahoma City. Oklahoma, Jerry, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I have a point of view that's probably not going to be welcome, but I don't think corporations are run for social reasons. They're controlled by boards of directors that operate in the interest of shareholders.
Well, that's very they're very clear, very explicit about that.
I'm sorry?
Most are very explicit about that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and we live by the quarterly earnings projection, and corporations are compelled to show higher earnings every quarter. There are three solutions, I think, to the problem. A, get a better education. There's a reason why community colleges are overflowing with people. They're getting their certificates to get into a higher-paying job. B, there would be some legislation. I don't know if that's going to happen because corporations control PACs. And the awful outcome would be social unrest, where people would take to the streets. So I don't think, you know, all this hand-wringing is wonderful, but the reality is that corporations are controlling the economics in the country. They're run for shareholders, and education is probably the way that people are going to get a higher-paying job. I see it out here in Oklahoma.
Listen, when that works, there's nothing better, but look at the numbers, and we don't have great performance on that score at the moment after a long time of talking and griping about it. Jason, what's your real formula? Because a lot of the things you're calling for, a bunch of them are already in place. There are a lot of government programs already. Meanwhile, you see the reality. The middle class decimated, and the lower class living on very little. You express sympathy. I get it. But how do we actually change this so it doesn't just go on year after year after year?
So, Tom, I think it's important first to set the record straight because David mentioned the idea of the literature showing consistent results that there's no harm raised in the minimum wage, and that's not true.
I've got a lot on the table here reading both ways on that.
But that's it. There's your point. There's a lot of both ways. David Newmark's done research showing the Kruger study was flawed. They're doing research now that says it reduces opportunities for low-skilled workers. So the takeaway here is that you can probably raise the minimum wage in Washington, D.C. at $10 an hour. I drive by McDonald's. They're offering jobs for $10.50 or $11. That's not going to hurt people here in D.C. or maybe even to help. What's it going to do to those in Ames, Iowa, in Nebraska, where the wage is much lower and we raise it and all of a sudden the cost of employment is too high? And I think what we've got to sit back and talk about here is what are we trying to do and what's the most cost-effective way to do it? Because the literature is mixed, and the takeaway is there are trade-offs. You're going to help some people. You're going to hurt others.
I'm asking you not to be stuck on that. Look beyond it. Maybe we'll do that. Maybe we won't. But we can't go on forever with so many Americans at lousy wages. There's our Oklahoma caller saying, what do you want, social unrest before we do something?
No, and what I want to do is realize that in this country we've got to sit back and stop looking for the short-term fix, which has long-term consequences.
I'm not seeing any long-term fix in what you're describing, though, because so many of the things you're saying haven't happened, and so here we sit.
Well, we have a dysfunctional Congress with a lot of partisanship, and that's based on the fact right now people aren't taking the time to do research to know the issues, and we have a dysfunctional Congress. We're not holding them to task, and that's where the fundamental problem is. It's right now in our governance and our citizenship.
David Cooper,
how do you change that?
Draw the connection in your argument between short-term. You'd raise the minimum wage, and then what? Because we know you can't just legislate prosperity.
Right.
You have to actually create it.
That's right. And actually, this gets at a much larger point, and that is that over the last 40 years, as our economy has grown, as the country has become a lot richer, and as our productivity has expanded tremendously, wages for most workers have been flat, and the minimum wage has fallen. You know, as they mentioned at the top of the hour, the minimum wage back in the late 1960s was about $10 an hour in today's dollars, and it's just been because we've let that value erode.
We got it. We know that's your argument. Let's say we did that. Then
right.
What?
So,
how do we make a sustainable upward curve again?
So here's what you do. You raise the minimum wage, and then you index it for inflation so that every year it's automatically adjusted to preserve its purchasing power.
You're still just legislating prosperity. Don't you want to put more legs under it than legislation, ultimately? What's your answer
there? Well, absolutely.
There?
The number one thing we need to do to fix all of these problems is to get the economy booming again. We need to get unemployment down so that employers are raising wages on their own in order to attract more people. But part of the solution is ensuring that we have strong labor standards, like a strong minimum wage, for exactly this situation where all the pressure on wages is down and we need to put a floor under it so that people can get by.
Well, we haven't seen much movement in recent years. We'll come back to you two and see what it looks like a little ways out to see if there's movement here. People are living on it right now, and it's not easy. I'm grateful to each of you for being here. David Cooper at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. Thank you for joining us this hour, David.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
And Jason Fichtner at the Mercatus Center, George Mason University. Jason, thank you for joining us.
As always, thanks, Tom.
In a moment, Pope Francis calls on the rich to share a little more. This is On Point. 8 months into his headline-making papacy, Pope Francis is turning heads again. Last week, Francis released The Joy of the Gospel. It was an apostolic exhortation in Vatican speak, a kind of mission statement or State of the Union address. It was notably critical of what the Pope called the idolatry of money and an economy of exclusion and inequality. The Pope wrote, "While the earnings of a minority are growing exponentially, so too is the gap separating the majority from the prosperity enjoyed by those happy few." For a closer look, we're joined now from Rome by Eric J. Lyman, a Rome-based writer covering the Vatican for the Religion News Service and USA Today. Eric Lyman, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
What kind of document was this exactly, and how important is it?
Well, it's the kind of document that that most of the time doesn't get a lot of attention because it deals with fairly esoteric or canonical or spiritual issues, and in the mainstream press, most folks don't talk about it. But because there was this aspect, this sort of biting critique of capitalism, this one sure turned a lot of heads.
More than a biting critique, really, right? I mean, he's talking about
biting. I meant to say biting. I'm sorry.
Biting, yes, quite biting. Give us the dimensions of the Pope's critique there.
Well, I mean, I don't think that it was meant to be a kind of an economic treatise. A lot of the criticism of the Pope's point of view in the European press, anyway, has been to make an equivalence between him and Karl Marx, and I don't think it was sort of meant to be a sort of policy initiative that a minister of finance or a central bank governor would adopt. But I think that he did want to cast some light on the growing disparity between the rich and poor, and point out some of the hypocrisy that's involved in some religious institutions and people who claim to be religious and institutions that claim to support religious points of view, fostering this widening gap.
The Pope writing, it's an 84-page apostolic exhortation, kind of roadmap for his papacy, you write, Eric, and he says in there, "How can it be that it is not a news item when an elderly homeless person dies of exposure, but it is news when the stock market loses 2 points?" It's the Pope writing about the stock market and the poor. Pope Francis also writing, says, this is, well, here it is. "Today," he wrote, "everything comes under the laws of competition and the survival of the fittest, where the powerful feed upon the powerless. As a consequence," the Pope writes, "masses of people find themselves excluded and marginalized, without possibilities, without any means of escape." This is very pointed language. This certainly gets deeply into economic politics, at the very least.
Well, I mean, this Pope is it's a short papacy, as you pointed out. So far, it's only 8.5 months or something like that. But he hasn't shied away from stating his point of view on a wide variety of issues, and certainly not just on economics, but on homosexuality within the church, on women's rights, on social justice, on politics, interreligious dialogue with other faiths, and so on. I think that this statement that he's made here is attracting attention from a new corner, but this fits into a wider point of view that the Pope has, which is that he needs to sort of be a kind of a moral guidance for the world and for Christians, and that touches on a lot of areas, including on economics.
How does this compare to his predecessors, his recent predecessors? I mean, he's using language here like the preferential option for the poor. We haven't heard that in a while. He writes, "None of us can think we're exempt from concern for the poor and for social justice." Is that, I don't mean to be glib, but is that boilerplate that goes into all papal statements, or is that something special in this Pope's statement?
Well, I don't think there's anything boilerplate about Pope Francis. I think that he is very original in the way that he's doing things. I don't think he's doing anything for effect. I think he's stating the things that he believes. Now, it's true that in the recent past, we haven't seen anything like this before. Pope Benedict XVI, who was Pope from 2005 to 2008, said nothing like this, and it would have been seemed as hypocritical if he had, because he was very much in sort of the old mold of the papacy with a lot of opulence and so on. And John Paul, in his waning years, also was unlikely to delve into such an area. But I think for a lot of people, he recalls the early years of John Paul II's papacy, and even more so, the very brief 33-day papacy of John Paul I in 1978. And these were both natural populists, as well as John the 23rd in the 1960s. And I think that that this kind of resonance that, those men had, speaking of John Paul II only in the early years of his papacy when he was much healthier, I think Francis is tapping into some of that, but of course with a Latin American accent and his own personality stamp on it as well.
Are they really calling him, comparing him to Karl Marx in the European press? Is that what you said?
I've seen a few things like that. I have, and there was a serious piece that came out in one of the Italian newspapers called Il Sole 24 Ore, which is the Italian equivalent of the Wall Street Journal, that that criticized him for weighing in on things that he didn't understand and drawing parallels with Marxism.
Well, he's the Pope, and they're not, I guess. What happens to conservative Catholics now who kind of had their guys in the papacy for the last several rounds? If Pope Francis goes in this direction, do they become the new cafeteria Catholics, sort of picking and choosing what they want to follow and focus on?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I don't know exactly what's going to happen, because in many ways Pope Francis is still a conservative Catholic. He's a Jesuit. He is not any kind of a theological liberal on issues related to the church, such as, you know, the role of women. He has not budged an inch on whether women would ever be ordained. You know, he did famously say, for example, about gay Christians, that who am I to judge? But he gave no indication that the church was going to change its rules on that sort of thing. So I think that they have something to hold on to, but at the same time, I mean, they, meaning the conservative Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
But
here's a new message. We're up against the clock, Eric. You're terrific. I appreciate you joining us. Eric Lyman writes for Religion News Service and USA Today. Thank you, Eric.
My pleasure.
The Pope writing, the world financial system has created an economy of exclusion and inequality. Going to be interesting to watch this papacy. Listeners, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.